I'm going to break out some that hopefully doesn't make Brian too excited here. I'm going to use this later in the sermon. Brian knows it is something that you reach high places with, the paint. So, okay, I'll go from there. Well, again, happy Sabbath. I know David already said that, but happy Sabbath. Because it truly is a blessing that we're able to be here together. And I'm just going to go ahead and dive right in. Since when I read mine, it was just on time, but I happen to ad-lib sometimes, so who knows how long it'll reach. But anyway, so it is so easy to be afraid of giants in our lives. We struggle with the world around us, whether it be the war that continues to progress in Eastern Europe between Ukraine and Russia. The failing economy that we see as bright as day around us with gas prices and food. I don't know if any of you had problems, but trying to get eggs at the local grocery store has been quite an issue. And I had guests come into town, they're like, what's the deal with the eggs? And I'm like, it's the precursor signs of other things coming. It's hard to find it. You had to look all over the place. There's anti-Christian laws that we had talked about, I think it was last Sabbath, that were passed, have to do with marriage, which will probably be something that we will have to bear later as we continue to preach what is truth from the Bible and not what man considers to be good or evil. Then there's biases against Christians in general. You can make fun of just about any Christian you want, and it should be okay, but not anyone else. I've tried to distance myself recently from the news because it quite frankly hurts. It hurts to watch and to listen as our politicians bicker back and forth about whose facts are facts and who's right and who's wrong. COVID has been going crazy in China ever since it broke out originally. And according to the Epic Times News, it's saying that the most recent outbreak, now they're allowing them to fly out. Which, I'm not afraid of COVID, however, I am afraid of the government knee-jerk reaction again. So as those folks spread across the world again, what's going to happen here in the United States or in Europe? Are the lockdowns going to come back again? Are we not going to be able to meet again? That scares me. We have Twittergate that came up recently. Things we already knew that were happening, where people were being banned for different ideas because they weren't what everyone else wanted to hear or a certain group wanted to hear. Facebook has done the same. We have the laptop that didn't get any kind of from Biden's son prior to the election and now seems to have relevant information on it, which many knew before that. Weaponizing of the different acronyms in our government from the FBI to the CIA. How all these things have changed so soon. I was listening to a sermon this week by Gary Petty, and in it he said, you know, he felt very proud of being bought of this country, but he said, and I'm going to paraphrase, that he no longer feels like this is his country. And it's sad to say I kind of feel the same way, and I love this country. I love everything about it up until the last decade or two. And I think all of you feel the same way. I mean, we live in one of the most beautiful parts of the country, the Rocky Mountains. I mean, how blessed are we? And this country is so blessed, but we see so many evils going on around us. There are these giants. We struggle with our past giants of ourselves, like the mistakes maybe that we made or things that we said or things that we did, decisions that weren't right. They come back and they haunt us, these giants that face us. Or our present giants. Sickness, illness, injuries, trials perhaps that we're going through right now. Perhaps we don't even let anyone know. Maybe there are those of you in there suffering right now from a giant that's on your back. But you don't want to let anyone know because there are other people that you know are suffering and you want to take away from them perhaps. And then there's the worry of the future giants to come. What's down the road? Man, everything's been going wrong lately. What's the next thing to hit me now? We all have giants. We all know the end of the story of this beautiful and magnificent book. that really you can gather so much from to build your life upon. But sometimes those pages that we are currently reading can seem frightening and too big when looking at the immensity of it all. We can become frozen with fear when looking into the prophecies of what is to come and what trials await us. We read about all the brave, faithful before, and somewhere deep inside we wonder, will we be able to rise to the occasion? Am I currently rising to the occasion? Am I the only one who fears this? I mean, I do. I look at the things that are in prophecy and I wonder, will I be like those who stood up and didn't fall? Or will I be one of those who does? I hope I will be one of those that rise up. I hope I'll be one of those that stand tall. But it's a fear inside of me. And maybe I'm the only one. But it is to me. Our daily lives may also harbor trials that seem perhaps too big and pains too deep to carry on, but we must find that courage, that faith to do so. But how? How do we find that strength? I think Brian's Cornerstone sermonette has some basis for that, or how we gain our strength. What giants do we face now, and what lurks in our future waiting for just that right moment to pounce on us? Today's sermon is entitled, Slaying Giants. Slaying Giants. It is my desire to illustrate through God's Word examples of slaying of giants in the lives of God's people through time. These people seem larger than life when we read of their immense faith. But we must see that they are really no different than you and I. I mean, we read about them, they're in the book. But we also travel through time. We also have giants that we've conquered and things that we've done. And flaws, just like those folks in the Bible. I want to provide you encouragement through Scripture for each and every one of you to build your temple upon and face what you are going through now and what trials may lay ahead. We will be looking at three examples today from the wonderful book, The Word of Our God, our Bible. We will be discussing Peter and his betrayal of Christ. Can you imagine what it would have been like if you were Peter, told that you're going to defy the great our God? And then sure enough, after that third denial, the rooster crows, and you saw your Savior's eyes, and you looked into his eyes, knowing you had just betrayed him, been by his side the whole entire time. What must that be like? Secondly, what was it like for Israel to face giants, the son of Anak, with their huge fortified cities and well-armored warriors that had to be engaged to acquire the land of promise? After being in Egypt for what, 400 some odd years? They had lost their way. Of course, they've come through great things. They made it through the sea. They'd been free. They'd seen the 10 plagues. But they've gone through so very much. And yet, here are these huge people that make them look like grasshoppers standing in front of them with these big, big cities. How would you react if you were them? Then there is David battling the giant Philistine warrior Goliath, clad in bronze, who probably shone like the light of the sun reflected off of his armor, and stood so tall. How would you feel in that position? Well, you probably all already know, because every day you battle giants. So let's start with David. David's battle with Goliath is a well-known story, and it all starts in 1 Samuel. If you want to go ahead and start turning there, 1 Samuel. But before we get into the story of Samuel, let's talk a little bit about those Philistines that are there. Because I honestly, up until I started writing this, didn't really know that much about them. Other than they're always a constant thorn in the side of Israel since traveling to and trying to conquer the land of promise, that's all I really knew. According to the Crossway Archaeological Study Bible, the Philistines were largely unknown by most outside of the Bible stories until excavations of Philistine cities started happening, of Ashkelon and Ashdod and Ekron and a few others, and I probably have butchered those names, so ask me later if you want spellings of them, because the pronunciations probably are way off. And the discovery of Egyptian and Ugaritic sources mentioning the sea peoples, and the reliefs on the wall of Ramses III's mortuary temple at Medinet Habu in Egypt. If you have the archaeological Bible, which Scott Ashley has told us many times over the few years I've been here to buy, which I did, I love it, it has that relief in stone of this great battle, this relief that it's talking about, where they learned more about the Philistines. The Zahara's papyrus and many other items that they've discovered that shed a light on who these people were, these sea people from the Aegean. These sources give a clear picture of who these sea people, the Philistines, were and where they came from. The Philistines were mercenary soldiers who appeared in Egypt records attempting to take over Western Egypt as members of the Libyan coalition. Then about 30 to 40 years later, they appear again in the relief in Ramses III mortuary temple, mentioning a large, huge land and sea battle in the northeast of Egypt on the Phoenician coast. And we know Egypt to be a very strong military state or country at that time, something very ominous in that area. They were powerful, but yet these troops, these Philistines, these people of the sea, came to attack, not once, but twice. Now, this battle that was depicted on Ramses' mortuary tomb is quite remarkable, but what happens is Ramses defeats them quite handedly, both at the sea and both in the land. And then those remaining vanquished, some of them were allowed to settle in the land of Canaan and southern Canaanite coast. And they ended up defeating the indigenous or people of those areas, and eventually establish themselves as a rival power. So they are a formidable force. These are the people that amass themselves at Socoh, which belongs to Judah on the mountaintop opposite of Israel. They are people who know war well and are powerful. The stage is set, and this is where we pick up the story of David and Goliath in 1 Samuel. Chapter 17, 1 Samuel chapter 17, in verse 1. And it's scary, I'm already dry, so we'll start this. Verse 1 of chapter 17. Now the Philistines gathered their forces for war and assembled at Socoh in Judah. They pitched camp at Iphis-Damima, between Socoh and Azekah. Saul and the Israelites assembled and camped in the valley of Elah and drew up their battle line to meet the Philistines. The Philistines occupied one hill and the Israelites on another, with a valley between them. Now this valley of Elah is approximately about a half a mile wide and then has a narrow trench that runs along the middle of it. Half a mile, how far is that? If you ever run track, it's two times around the track. If you're a long-distance runner and you run an eight-minute mile, just easy going, not me easy going, but, you know, one of you healthier people, that's like 4 minutes to cover that if it's a nice, easy, flat area. So about a four-minute jog from one side to the other is how large this valley was where they're coming down to battle. Verse 4, a champion named Goliath, who was from Gath, came out of the Philistine camp. His height was 6 cubits and a span. He had a bronze helmet on his head and wore a coat of steel armor of bronze weighing 5,000 shekels. On his legs were bronze greaves, and a bronze javelin was slung on his back. His spear shaft was like a weaver's rod, and its iron point weighed 600 shekels. His shield bearer went ahead of him. I know we've heard many messages on Goliath and many Bible studies that covered this area and have told us how big this is and how heavy this is, but I think it's still a good idea to go back over it again just to understand what we're talking about. Because when I read about 6 cubits, that means about nothing to me. When I hear about shekels, weighing 5,000 shekels, that means another nothing. I have no clue, none. Now, I've heard it a bazillion times, but that doesn't stick in my head. I know pounds somewhat when I weigh myself every morning and cry. And I know height. I know I'm not as tall as I once was. That bothers me. But I don't know what these measurements mean. So what I want to do today is kind of illustrate Goliath's height. That 6 cubits in a span is approximately 9 foot 9 inches, is what I was able to gather. Now, I brought this here to illustrate how tall Goliath is. Right now, this is not Goliath. This is Goliath. I can't put Goliath on the stage. This is 9 foot 9 inches. The tallest man that we know of is it's Robert Wadlow. And there's a statue of him in Alton, Illinois, in which he's depicted in metal. He was 8 foot 11 inches. Some of his life he could walk just fine, but majority of it, he had a cane. When people get really tall, they have the gigantism. They have a tendency to be weak, unable to walk around. Goliath's armor, the chainmail that was on his chest, that was so many shekels in weight, was 121 pounds just by itself. Those of you backpackers around here who go backpacking for distances, you're looking for less than 30 pounds, right? You know, and ultralight is much, much less than that. Or noobs like me will pack it up and say, let's go, and then fall dead, right? But can you imagine 121 pounds just on your chest, not including your helmet of bronze, your greaves, the javelin that's thrown over your back, and they mentioned that weaver's rod. That means diddly squat to me as well. I'm sorry I'm not where the microphone is. And there's no way I'm going to get this to fit. This right here is 12 feet. His spear is between 10 and 12 feet long. So he's 9 foot 9, larger than Shaquille O'Neal, larger than anyone that we have recorded. And his spear is 10 to 12 feet long. At the top of that is an iron, spearhead. That was, I think, let me look back here in my notes, 26 inches long and 7.8 inches wide. So, right there-ish wide. And weighed by itself 15 pounds, just a spearhead. The shaft, approximately 10 pounds, give or take just a little bit. This is that giant Goliath with his shining bronze armor standing before you. Think about how heavy this Goliath's armor and weapons were. His size and the armament would make him an extremely fierce foe. His spear alone, if he threw it, kind of reminds me of the Roman weapons that they had that were like basically like very large, I can't remember the names of them, but very large crossbows almost, but they had these huge spears on it, and they would shoot those out, and it would impale multiple people. This spear, if this man of 9 foot 9 threw, could do the exact same thing. How many of you, when you're younger, could dunk a basketball? I did it twice, right? I lived on that rim. I could jump up there, but I had these little tiny hands, can't hold the ball. But that was my claim to fame when I was thinner. That 10-foot rim is just slightly above Goliath's head and the smallest version of the spear. That's pretty high. Let's continue on verse 8, after we kind of have an idea of who this Goliath was, how big he was, and what kind of a fearsome guy he is. Goliath stood and shouted, to the ranks of Israel, "Why do you come out and line up for battle? Am I not a Philistine, and are you not the servants of Saul? Choose a man and have him come down to me. If he is able to fight and kill me, we will become your subjects. But if I overcome him and kill him, you will become our subjects and serve us." Then the Philistine said, "This day I defy the armies of Israel. Give me a man and let us fight each other." On hearing the Philistine's words, Saul and all the other Israelites were dismayed and terrified. I think we were standing there ourselves in the garb of that time, ready to go to war. If a man that size, with the weapons that he had and the confidence that he had, I think we might be a little afraid too. We get afraid every day on things much smaller than Goliath, don't we? Certain things come into our lives, make us doubt. Here's this huge man here. David is then introduced in verses 12 through 15 of 1 Samuel 17, whom we know well as the youngest of Jesse's 8 sons, who was tasked with herding their family's sheep. Jesse's 3 oldest sons were at the front lines battling the Philistines at this time. And now there is something I find interesting as I was reading, because I'm kind of weird. If you look at verse 16 of chapter 17, something I find interesting. And I probably will be the only one in this room, but maybe you will after I tell you. So verse 16 says, "For 40 days the Philistine came forward and took his stand morning and evening." Other than "I am peculiar," why do you think I find this verse interesting? Any guesses? Anyone? Have I not given you enough information? Any ideas? 40. The 40 days, yeah. 40 days, or 40, usually signifies a new life, new growth, transformation, a change from one trial or task to another potential trial or task. For example, Moses on Mount Sinai, he was up there with God for 40 days. Moses again lived in Egypt up until he was 40 years old. And the next chapter of his life began to serve God. Moses again sends out the spies to check out the promised land to report the good news to the peoples. They scout the land of promise for 40 days. Then there is the 40 years of wandering of Israel in the wilderness until every one of the rebellious generation passed away. And the next generation could claim the land of promise. Noah on the ark, rain for 40 days and 40 nights, and then the water started receding. Jesus fasted for 40 days before having his trial with Satan. All these are examples of change, trials, and new. And I don't think, I think these numbers are in here for multiple reasons. But one of the big ones is kind of a silent little sleeper is to know that God is being involved throughout time. Because many who don't believe could say, that was coincidence. That was just an earthquake up the stream, and that's what caused the waters to go a different direction. But God puts these numbers, these exactness in times as he's going through these stories so that we know that he has a hand in these things. At least that's what I believe. You're not going to find that written here, but that's what I think. That's what I think as I'm reading them. There is, however, something else that's interesting here. And I'm not going to ask you this time, but again, maybe it's because I'm kind of a weird guy, but I also see another interesting thing. That 40 is a number that's also divisible by 8, 5 times. 8. Why is the equation important to anyone other than me? It's probably not. But 8 is also important here to signify a new commitment, submission, and eternity. And I will come back to these numbers later in our story to kind of see why they have some relevance here. So back to the story. I apologize for wandering off. But verse 17 and 18, David's father Jesse orders David to bring food to his older brothers and to bring back news and proof of his brothers' well-being. David rose early the next morning and went on his task to see his brothers at the valley site in the Valley of Elah. He arrived as it's written that the encampment of the host was going out to battle, to the battle line, shouting the war cry. Verse 22 through 27, if you're following along, just giving you just snapshots of it. David is introduced to Goliath for the very first time, and we're going to pick it up here. Verse 22 through 27. And David left the things in charge of the keeper of the baggage and ran to the ranks and went and greeted his brothers. As he talked with them, behold, the champion, the Philistine of Gath, Goliath by name, came up out of the ranks of the Philistines and spoke the same words as before, and David heard him. So he went up there and he challenged the Israelites again. Now David heard him. I want to stop here for a moment and reflect. Have we not all heard and seen giants? I don't mean the physical ones. I mean the figurative ones. What I mean is, haven't we been presented over time with giant trials, giant sins, that seem like this man Goliath, unstoppable, unbreakable, undefeatable? Has Satan not come up to you and laid the gauntlet down, challenged you and your connection with God? When Satan challenges you, he's also challenging God. Remember how Job was talked about by Satan to God? Satan knows you will buckle under the pressure of whatever he's allowed to throw at you, just like he thought he'd be able to do the same to Job. In Job 1, verse 11, Satan says, "But stretch out your hand and touch all that he has, and he will curse you to your face." Satan thinks he knows you better than God. Does he? Is he going to win? Perhaps just time and chance has thrown you a curveball as well. It seems so impossible that it is like a 9-foot-9-inch giant, armed with bronze, staring at you with ill will and intent in his eye. How can we deal with that? Let's continue reading and see what happens in the story. I know we all know well. We're going to glean it. Verse 24. All the men of Israel, when they saw the man, fled from him and were much afraid. I think I would be afraid. I think most of us would be afraid of this guy, right? And the men of Israel said, "Have you seen this man who has come up? Surely he has come up to defy Israel. And the king will enrich the man who kills him with great riches and will give him his daughter and make his family's house free in Israel." And David said to the men who stood by, "What shall be done for the man who kills this Philistine and takes away the reproach from Israel?" Well, they just said it, but he asked it. "For who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God?" And the people answered him in the same way, "So shall it be done to the man who kills him." Then in verse 28 through 29 is David's brother speaking to David, making a judgment call on his little brother's reasoning for speaking about Goliath as one looking for entertainment or merely curiosity. He judges his motives as not well. David reacts like any other sibling would, any other younger brother. It's like, "Hey, what have I done now?" That's what he actually says there. "What have I done now?" And then verse 24 through 30, David is told three times, what will happen if Goliath is slain. He asks twice and is told thrice. Is this important? Does it mean anything? I just found it weird that it was redundantly asking again after he's already been told. I love details and clues in God that God leaves for us in his word that we can find if we look hard or if we read again and again. Sometimes it's like reading a mystery novel or something like that. The game is afoot. Three is a sign of completion and good. If we were reading this account for the first time and had no idea how this story was going to end up, the numbers would give us those clues. There's also a lesson here to learn. Here are two different reactions recorded in this story. The one of common man, verse 24, and of David in verse 26. There are always two choices. Stand and fight, or flee and be defeated. Which do you choose when that giant knocks on your door? Now, to be more exact, the stand and the fight isn't alone. David wasn't alone when he eventually makes this decision to fight Goliath. It isn't by your might, nor in this story is it by David's might. So let's continue reading. In verse 31 through 35, David is addressing Saul, who understandably doubts David's ability to slay Goliath, this little guy. He goes out there and tends sheep. He's kind of cocky, maybe in his eyes. He's going to kill this big Goliath that all of us are afraid of. So David is giving Saul his resume at this point, because Saul doubts him. First he tells Saul he is his man for the job. In verse 32 he says, "And David said to Saul, 'Let no man's heart fail because of him. Your servant will go and fight with this Philistine.'" I'm your man. I can do it. I know I can. Then later David gives his qualifications for thinking he is right for the job. In verse 34 he says, "Your servant used to keep sheep for his father, and when there came a lion or a bear and took a lamb from the flock, I went after him and struck him and delivered it out of his mouth." That's pretty impressive. I don't think I would be chasing a lion or a bear. And at that time, there were lions and bears in that area. Lions are huge and scary. I think I was in the Milwaukee Zoo. They had a glass enclosure with a lion on one side and a female lion with him, a male and female, and a tiger that would come in and out because the weather was nasty. And as soon as that lion eyeballed that tiger, he let out the most ferocious roar that made my insides shake. It was just, I'm not going to do it. I'm tempted, but I'm not going to do it. But just this roar. I'm like, I stood still. I knew that he could not get me. I knew that he wasn't running at myself and my children, but he was eyeballing that tiger over there who acted like it was nothing, just kept on going because that's how tigers are. And I thought, wow, that's pretty immense. That's pretty scary. So David chased down lions, and I've seen bears, and I don't want to be ripped apart by bears, but he chased them down, delivered them out of his mouth. We continue reading. "And if he arose against me, the lion or the bear, I caught him by his beard and struck him and killed him. Your servant has struck both down lions and bears, and this uncircumcised Philistine shall be like one of them." So confident. Because he's done it before. He's done amazing things before. David is showing us the stages of slaying giants in our own lives with just what we've read so far. We should not fear. There are 365 mentions in the Bible of fear not. And there's a reason for that. We are God's people. With whom shall we fear? Then another important part of slaying giants is remembering the past victories God has given us. When has he come to your aid? When has he rescued you? When has he put something in your path that you need in order to accomplish something? When did he give you that lovely wife? Or that wonderful husband that made you whole? You have also witnessed God's intervention with others, those around you, in church and in your lives, when he saved them or helped them. You've seen it, you know it. The next giant will be slain just like the rest if we adhere to the next part of the story, which is in verse 37. 37 is the answer to slaying giants. "The Lord who delivered me from the paw of the lion and the paw of the bear will deliver me from the hand of this Philistine." He had great faith because he knew that his victories, no matter how great or how small, just like ours that we've had in the past, were not because of anything that we have done or that our neighbor has done. It's because God intervened. God is the strong one. That's the key point. We must remember who is actually strong enough to do battle. God. There is no you, there is no me, there's only God. He is strong. He is good. And He is our high tower of strength and refuge. We all know how this story ends. David goes boldly with God, defeats Goliath, and starts an upward arc of him being king. Now, this upward arc doesn't mean that David's future was smooth, because we all know it wasn't. We've read. But his course of following God was set. He was heading towards a direction. He would have ups and terrible downs, but it was always God who slayed his giants along the way. I want to go back to the questions about the numbers I posed earlier, the 40, the 8, and the 3. What is the importance of these numbers in this story? They're just interesting. Let's recap with the 40. Goliath tormented the people of Israel for 40 days till David beheaded him and things changed. Sometimes we may go through trials or sins for a long time. 40 days, 40 years, like 40 years in the wilderness for the people of Israel. But there is an outcome. There is an end to that trial and a change awaits once your character has taken its needed shape. God is molding us like clay. He's the great potter. He's shaping us into what we need to be because there's more ahead. The things I fear in prophecy in the future, if I allow Him, God is shaping me now to take care of those giants in the future as He is with every single one of you sitting here, if you fear that. He's shaping you now to defeat giants. God is using this trial period to either mold you or use you as an example to mold or encourage others around you. Those of you who are going through difficult times, and we are praying for you, for God to intervene, are lights. Every single one of you that was mentioned to pray about are lights to us too. Because if we pray for you, we can see your strength and we can see God's accomplishments through you. And through your sorrows, your pains, you are actually glorifying God because we can see His marvelous works within you. We see you as strong, even though you may see yourself as weak when you go through your trial. We see you as pillars of faith, even though you may feel as if your faith is waning as you're going through it. If you, in your battle with giants, are allowing God to work within you, you become a shining light so bright that it shines back to glorify God through your troubles, through your sorrows and your pain and your tears. In our trials, we help glorify God. In our struggles, God not only changes us, but those around us. Does that make sense? To save the innocent, there's an individual that I knew in church. From where I'm from, on the day this individual got baptized, they got baptized out in an ocean. And they got infected with this parasite the very day they were baptized. One of the happiest moments of a Christian's life, right? When you're accepting God and you're becoming part of His family. And this person got infected. And it just destroyed her inside. She can't eat certain things. And it's been a labor for her for a long period of time. She then also gets in an accident, and it hurts part of her brain. And so she's not able to do the things that she wants to do. And I've looked at her for years. She's one of my best friends. And I see how strong she is. And I can't imagine being her. She encourages me that I would hope I would be that strong. Every single one of you that sit in these seats who ask for prayers, who have things going wrong, in your lives. Maybe you're not sharing them. Share them. Because you make other people stronger by seeing the faith. Now, you may have had days. She had lots of days where she felt very low. We had many conversations where she didn't think she was had enough faith, and she fell down many times. But to me, she was an inspiration. There are many of you around here who are an inspiration to others and don't even know it. Allow yourself to be that mirror that reflects that glory back on God. The trial, your Goliath will not last forever. There is change coming, and it will be for the good if you allow it. 8 was another number that I had mentioned. I found interesting earlier in this message. 8 is the number that is divisible into 40. 8's meanings are a sign of a new commitment, submission, the offering of the firstborn, and eternity. I think all these apply in our lives, and in most of them, they somewhat apply in this story as well. Firstly, a new commitment. A new commitment was begun in Israel with the eventual reign of David. He was a good king. The tipping point was what projected David into the position that God had ordained him for, to be king of Israel. In our lives, each trial's end brings us closer to God and recommit to our relationships. And we recommit to our relationships to God as long as we allow it and get back up. When that giant may knock us down, we get back up every single time. Because the only time that we can't succeed is when you no longer get back up. When you said, I've had enough. When that giant has hit you so many times that you look and you go, I can't do it. I can't. Allow God's strength to pick you back up and get back up again. Then there's submission. David realized that all the strength and power wasn't his. It was God. And he submitted boldly to God as his protector. And we must submit to God's power, God's will in our lives, if we want to move forward just like David. He's the power. 8 is a sign of offering of the firstborn to God and the circumcision. We are his firstborn, his first fruits, who upon every successful trial of our character, it's like re-circumcising our heart, making it more of flesh and less of stone, because God's molding us to the way he wants us to be. Lastly, 8 is the eternity, like the 8th day of the feast. We don't know when the last trial we conquer is our last trial. And we are brought into God's eternal family, but someday it will be. Someday that last time that you get up is the last time you have to get back up. Don't give up. We are fighting each of our fights with God in our corner for eternity to be in God's family. It's important. Now, David was a great example of fighting a giant, but he wasn't the only one. The people of Israel, after leaving Egypt, faced literal giants as well. Please turn, if you would, to the book of Numbers, chapter 13. Numbers 13. Just prior to God instructing Moses to send out spies in the land of Canaan, mentioned in chapter 13, we had kind of that buildup as Miriam and Aaron opposing Moses' leadership. God literally makes his presence known and his will by coming in person to discipline them both. Miriam was cursed with leprosy, which she had for 7 days. And the people were encamped in the wilderness of Paran near Kadesh Barnea, which most will find on their map inserts in the back of your Bible, if you want to find out where that looks like, where it is, or on the very same page that we are looking at right now. Now, up until Mr. Ashley explained what wilderness was in this area, I always thought of wilderness as when we go out into the mountains, not when we get really high, but when we're in the area in which we have all these trees. And that's what I always thought of wilderness. That, to me, it seemed like a great place to be. I love that place. So when I originally would read about this, that's what I thought about. Oh, they're in this awesome wooded pine tree forest that I just so love. And it's got all these little animals running around. But that is not what we're talking about. It's not a wooded wilderness, but a barren, rocky landscape with minimal plant life. It reminds me of what you would find in our, maybe the alpine tundra biomes at about 11,000 feet, except for the extreme cold. It's rocky, there's scraggly vegetation, but it's sparse and rocky. I say this just to give you an idea in your mind's eye of what's going on with Israel at this point in time. There's over 600,000 people encamped in this sparse, moon-like, I guess you'd say, a landscape. It's not fun. Not a good-looking area. So verse 1. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Send men to spy out the land of Canaan, which I am giving to the people of Israel. From each tribe of their fathers you shall send a man, every one a chief among them." So Moses sent them from the wilderness of Paran, according to the command of the Lord, all the men who were heads of the people. I'm going to get this out of the way since I don't need it now. I'm afraid it's going to fall. So something that I just noticed as I'm reading, for some reason I didn't notice before, is these were chiefs among each one of the tribes. They were important people. So these folks that were going out actually, I would think, spoke for those individuals, right? So they represented the clan, the tribe, the family that they were with. So if they said something, it kind of meant for everybody. They were in charge. Let's move down to verse 17. This will be important later. Moses sent them to spy out the land of Canaan and said to them, "Go up into the Negeb and go up into the hill country and see what the land is and whether the people who dwell in it are strong or weak, whether they are few or many, and whether the land that they dwell in is good or bad, and whether the cities that they dwell in are camps or strongholds, and whether the land is rich or poor, and whether there are trees or not. Be of good courage and bring some of the fruit of the land." And the time that they were going up is the season of the first ripe grapes. Excuse me. So the men are sent out to explore the land of promise over the next 40 days. There is a 40 again, and yes, the meanings are very similar to what we had discussed with David and Goliath. The spies return and give their assessment of the opportunities in front of them. In verse 26 through 33, is where the details of their adventure are given. The land flows with milk and honey. It is filled with people who are very strong. The land has the descendants of Anak, who are said to be giants and make the spies seem like grasshoppers in size to them. It's a pretty big difference. I don't know if they're exaggerating, or if that's exactly how much bigger they were than them, I don't know. But they were big. They were intimidating. Everything about it was intimidating and frightening to these chieftains of the tribes of Israel. They also mention the fortified cities and how much stronger they believe the inhabitants are than they, except for Caleb and Joshua. Caleb says in verse 30, "But Caleb quieted the people before Moses and said, 'Let us go up at once and occupy it, for we are well able to overcome it.'" Is it just me, or does Caleb remind you of anyone perhaps that we just read about? Perhaps David with his response to the people of the land, the peoples of the land of promise? And I think, yes, he does sound like David, where David says, "Let no man's heart fail because of him. Your servant will go and fight this Philistine," he said. I think it's very similar. They have that same heart. They have that same courage based in what they've seen. Caleb had a heart like David here and knew from what he had experienced with the Exodus from Egypt that nothing could stand in their way as long as God was by their side. And also very similar to the story of David and Goliath is the response of the majority of the people. They doubted. They doubted. They doubted so much so that in chapter 14, They are recorded as rebelling against Moses and Aaron. This end of 40 days, instead of meaning an end of one trial in victory when the spies came back, and with the beginning of another trial or episode in life, is a story, unfortunately, of defeat, and then another trial. Israel would begin their 40 years of wandering in the wilderness. It doesn't mean they won't be fighting at this time, but they're going to be wandering for 40 years, unable to fulfill their inheritance into the land of promise, until all except Caleb and Joshua, all except those two, had passed away, and the new generation came up. It is so easy when reading these lessons from the past to say, well, they should have done this or that. I wouldn't have done that. But they've been through a lot. And yes, they have seen a lot that we have not seen. We've not seen a parting of a sea. We've not seen 10 plagues of that severity which allowed you to escape this immense force of people. But yet they'd also spent 400 years in a place. I think they'd probably lost a lot of what they knew at one point or time. So they're just common people, right? They make mistakes. And they did here. And they weren't able to make it in that promised land. We must learn from this. I'm sorry, I lost my place. We must learn from this is an everyday. This is our everyday, our opportunity to cross over the land of promise. Every day we have this time. Every day we have this opportunity to make the right decision. Every day we have trials and opportunities to make the right decision and live with God as our lead or ourselves as the lead. And we've got to make a choice. We can take encouragement from all these stories and lessons. And that is, with God, my brothers and sisters, all things are possible and all things work out to the goodness and purpose of God, even when we cannot see it ourselves because we're so stuck in the fight with that giant. Joshua eventually enters the promised land with Caleb and the next generation, and handily removes the sons of Anak. God's will be done, giants or no giants. Please turn to Joshua chapter 14, verses 10 through 12. Joshua 14, 10 through 12. Sam's already standing. I think he thinks he's coming up here sometime soon. He's not. Joshua 14, 10 through 12. And now behold, the Lord has kept me alive, just as he said, these 45 years since the time that the Lord spoke this word to Moses, while Israel walked in the wilderness. And now behold, I am this day 85 years old. I'm still as strong today as I was in the day that Moses sent me. My strength is as my strength was then. For war and for going and coming. I know mine's not. Verse 12. So now give me this hill country of which the Lord spoke on that day. For you heard on that day how the Anakim were there with great fortified cities. It may be that the Lord will be with me and I shall drive them out just as the Lord said. And he did. Now so far we have talked about or been reading about literal giants that have been overcome by either the Israelites or by David in the lives of those who have the privilege that we have the privilege of reading about in the Bible. But not all giants in our lives are literally 9 foot, 9 inches tall, as we know. Our giants are figurative, not literal, although they may feel like giants. Peter had to face his own personal giants just like we do. But I think this was beyond what we feel on a daily basis, but perhaps we should feel like Peter does in this moment. Please turn, if we would, to John, which we were in quite a bit in the sermonette. John chapter 13, verse 36 through 38. John 13. Simon Peter said to him, Lord, where are you going? And Jesus answered him, where I am going, you cannot follow me now, but you will follow afterward. Verse 37, Peter said to him, Lord, why can I not follow you now? I will lay down my life for you. Peter, always out there, always bold, saying something like that. Then verse 38, Jesus answered, "Will you lay down your life for me? Truly, truly, I say you, the rooster will not crow till you have denied me three times." We've read this many times, right? This is the moment in time when a giant would be placed in Peter's future. The denying of God three times. Peter, who came out of the boat and started to walk on water to meet Christ, and then doubt and fear took over as the waves were there, and he fell in. "Lord, Lord, help me." Peter, who said, "You shall not wash my feet, Lord." The very same Peter who replied to Christ when asked, "Who do you think I am?" Matthew 16:16 records, "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God." And then Jesus answers him and said, "Blessed are you, Simon Barjona, for flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father who is in heaven." This very Peter, who was bold, passionate, and full of faith, would deny Jesus not once, but three times. Why did God allow this giant to be put in Peter's life? Do you ever ask that question when you're reading this? I mean, it seems terrible that he did it, but why? Why is this happening to him? Now, I can't make a judgment call on why Peter needed this, but I can give you a story of my life a little bit, and I'm no Peter. But I grew up in the church. I consider myself very knowledgeable in the church, but I looked at others who didn't know the truth as heathens or pagans or not able to know what I knew. I was arrogant in that knowledge. But there's a small piece of me that started to grow of, well, I kind of wish I could do the things that they did, or they're always the popular people, or they're always having fun, they're always doing this, and that started to grow in me, and God allowed it, I think, to grow in me. And I left the church. And I became like those people that I looked down on at one point in time. And I'm not proud of that. I'm not proud that I left either. But I was doing all the things that they did. And I became like them, so much so that I realized I was no different. I was given a gift, and I was humbled, and God let me back in. I don't know why. I didn't think I knew why until recently, and I think it's all the bad, stupid things I've done I can use as examples so that no one else will do the same things. That we all can help each other in that area. And I think because I was humbled in that time period when I came back, and I'm still growing, I'm still trying to get there. But Peter, I think, needed to be humbled. I think this was a humbling point in time so that he could do the work that God required from him from that point on. I don't know. That's what I think. And we all know this story very well. If we go to Luke chapter 22, verse 54 through 62, we'll read what happened once this opportunity, this giant, came into his life. "Then they seized him and led him away, bringing him into the high priest's house. And Peter was following at a distance. And when they had kindled a fire in the middle of the courtyard and sat down together, Peter sat down among them." Like when we have our camp outing, we got that fire going. If you go too far away from that fire, it goes right into darkness. But when you're up close to that fire, you can see everybody, mostly. It's flickering back and forth. It's a fun time. This is where we're at. We've got a fire going. So the light isn't great, but it's good enough if you're close to the fire. "Then a servant girl, seeing him as he sat in the light and looking closely at him, said, 'This man also was with him.' But he denied it, saying, 'Woman, I do not know him.' And a little later, someone else saw him and said, 'You also are one of them.' And Peter said, 'Man, I am not.' And after an interval of about an hour, still another insisted, saying, 'Certainly this man also was with him, for he too is a Galilean.' But Peter said, 'Man, I do not know what you are talking about.'" I'm sure we could all be there, maybe denying something. "And immediately while he was still speaking, the rooster crowed. And the Lord turned and looked at Peter. And Peter, remembered the saying of the Lord, how he had said to him, 'Before the rooster crows today, you will deny me three times.' And he went out and bitterly wept. Or wept bitterly. Peter actually had to look into our master, our brother, our high priest, our God's eyes once he denied him. Peter felt what he did viscerally to his core. Peter wasn't the only one that day, or wasn't the only one to ever deny God. And let me personalize it. This and not personalize this and not use the word we or us. But I've denied God every time I've sinned. I may not look into his eyes when I break, when I fall, but when you sin. Every time I've chosen to go the way of sin versus the way of light and life, I've denied my Savior. Those eyes staring back at Peter, those eyes stare into me too. Every sin should invoke this level of emotion when we think about it, what we're really doing. What we're here to be is very important. And every action and every choice that we make has consequences and is important. And yes, we are saved, but they're important. Beyond this point is the actual hope and purpose of this part of the message. Peter did not allow this moment in time to define him. Often when we make a big fall, many won't get back up again. We talked about getting back up. This is pretty severe. I mean, you're looking at Christ. But he did not allow self-pity and shame to take over. Don't get me wrong, Peter wasn't a machine. He felt what he did, but we don't have any narrative beyond this initial grief, seeing that he sulked and went away. He did not go away. Peter overcame the most horrible giant of all and turned a failed trial into a success. Peter accomplished much in his life and his ministry of Christ, and is awaiting to rise again to see his master and ours, Jesus Christ, when he returns. He was humbled, and he became a good servant. This is an example of hope and encouragement. If a great giant as this can be slain, and a life's journey plotted to do the will of God, can we not also do the same with our giants? Slaying giants is what we are here to do as God's royal priesthood. Every Feast of Trumpets, we are commanded to look back and to remember. This holy day is there to give us strength and to remember when God saved us. Not Joe Blow next door, not the President of the United States, not this tank or airplane, but God saved us. We need to look back daily in the Bible, in our lives, in the lives of those around us, and remember when God slayed giants. No matter what you may be facing now, nor what you may face in the future, nor how long that giant has been marching out morning after morning and night after night, cursing you and slapping you in the face, God can and God will conquer it for us. We know this because of this book that we all have in our laps or on our computers. The Bible, the lessons within. We know Joseph, who was sold by his brothers, who was accused of doing something he didn't do and landed in prison, and who rose to greatness. We know of Paul, who suffered over the years. We know of David and the Psalms. How many different Psalms you read through here where he's bitterly weeping to God, deliver me from these people who are pursuing me, who are trying to kill me. We know these stories. We know Job, who had his entire family taken away. We know that he was covered in boils and laid in ash, wanting to die. And his friends came and accused him. We know what he went through. We know what Christ did for us and all that he suffered. And on and on. We know this because of the lions God has slain for us in our own paths. We know this because the giants we witnessed him slay for others around us. We know this. We know this because There is no giant that God can't slay.